Hey everyone, Kyle here. Welcome back to the Climbing Majority podcast, where Max and I sit down with living legends, professional athletes, certified guides, and recreational climbers alike to discuss the topics, lessons, stories, and experiences found in the life of a climber. If you haven't already, please subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you get your podcasts. As we've seen on this podcast, there can be some serious consequences to playing in the mountains. One thing that seems to stay consistent is that no matter how traumatic the injury or how devastating the loss, we are always finding our way back to the mountains. Why is that? What calls us back to the activity and the environment that caused the pain in the first place? Our guest today is Steph Abegg, climber, photographer, adventurer, and math and data nerd. For as long as she can remember, she has been triply affected with the insatiable thirst for adventure, a persistent awe of the natural world, and a need to document the world around her. During her years of adventure and alpine climbing, Steph witnessed a major accident and sustained two major injuries herself that would have completely sidelined most athletes. But for her, not climbing, not being in the mountains was simply just not an option. As she puts it, the mountains are in my blood. In our conversation, we dive deep into Steph's past, chat about three major accidents, discuss her recent move to Estes Park, and finally, we cover her website, where she has meticulously documented over 750 routes with trip reports, photos, and route overlays.
Well, awesome. Welcome back to the Climbing Majority, everybody. We're sitting down here with Steph. Is it Steph or Stephanie? I see Stephanie on your screen.
I'd say Steph.
What do you like? Steph? Okay. Steph. All right, Steph. We're sitting here with Steph Abegg. And, you know, I'm actually pretty excited to be sitting here with you, Steph, because for multiple reasons. One, a fan of yours actually recommended you to be on the show. They were a follower of your website and of your trip reports, and they just like, we're super excited to share you with me and with us. And so thank you to whoever that was. I'll find your name and reach out to you again and let you know when the episode's published. But you're the reason why we're sitting here with Steph right now. And I'm just super excited that that kind of evolved the way it did. Secondly, I'm super excited to be sitting here because the sheer volume of accomplishments and things that you've done in your life up to this point is staggering, and I am baffled at one, how it's possible. And, you know, just to name a few, a photographer, a writer, you have multiple publications over the last decade, you are super successful in the academic world, your career, multiple injury recoveries, and just the sheer volume of documentation of all of this along the way on your website especially has been just, like I said, staggering and super impressive. So I'm really excited to kind of getting into, you know, the roots here on who you are and how this whole, you know, website and your story evolved. So yeah, just I'm definitely super excited to be sitting down with you.
Thank you.
Yeah. In general, just like I, you know, share Kyle's stoke and excitement and everything. And I think, you know, for the podcast, we usually like to do a nice deep dive and everything. And so why don't we start off? You give us a little bit of introduction of, you know, who you are. And we like to like, we go way back in the past, you know, like where'd you grow up, how'd you find climbing, all that kind of stuff. So if we can maybe go back to the beginning and get a well-rounded view of who you are, Steph.
Okay. I'll go way back to the beginning. My parents, they met in the Olympic Mountains while hiking. My dad was hiking one way and my mom was hiking the other, and they decided to spend camp in the same place that night. And basically, they were married within 7 days of knowing each other. So my dad, he drove back to his home in Illinois. Wow. And then he packed up his stuff, said, I'm getting married, and drove back, and they got married. So
Well, I can understand. I was seeing the pictures. Your dad was a stud. Did you see those quads? That guy was fit, man.
He was very fit. They were both very fit.
Yeah.
They lived a life in the mountains, and that was kind of their life for the first 10 years. And then they had the decision. We're getting into our mid-30s now. Do we start a family, or do we continue to climb and then, you know, figure out life after that? And they decided to start a family. So that's where I came about. And then my sister a year and a half later. And so I was born in 1983, which makes me 39 right now, almost 40. And let's see, I was born in Washington, Tacoma, Washington. And then my family moved to Israel for 4 years as my dad pursued his PhD work over there. And then we moved back to the Midwest. And eventually, when I was about 12, we made it back out to the West Coast when we moved to British Columbia, Canada. For my dad, he got a teaching job at a university there, Trinity Western University in near Vancouver, British Columbia. And my parents are still living up there. And so I went to high school there. And, you know, it's just a nice, beautiful place where you can see the mountains. Climbing started to become on the radar. We started to go backpacking to the North Cascades quite regularly and just kind of got hooked on mountain adventure. That was just the way that we spent our summers together as a family, was to go off into the North Cascades for multiple days. We even did the Ptarmigan Traverse when I was quite young still. And, you know, it's a 7-day traverse through the North Cascades, pretty popular now. So pretty amazing. Lots of great memories as a family doing that kind of stuff. And then, so I went to California for my undergraduate degree, and that's where I got into rock climbing for the first time. I joined the Alpine Club, and we're going to Yosemite every other weekend just to, you know, learn anchors and lead climbing and just how to climb basically safely. And I was like, oh, I could spend my life doing this. And pretty much when I came home from university there, I combined that whole technical aspect of climbing that I'd gotten from, you know, the stuff I'd done in California with the mountaineering that I'd done with my parents way back when, and just kind of took it to alpine climbing in the North Cascades for several years. And it just kind of grew on me, and that became my passion. Did that for until I moved in, let's see, in like 2019, I moved to Colorado. So I was doing that for maybe 13 years in Washington. And during that time is when my website just kind of randomly started and then kind of took off as an obsession of mine, and, you know, documenting trip reports, showing photography, all that kind of stuff, statistical studies, just kind of anything I would think of that I wanted to share or document, even just for myself, I just put on my website. And so it kind of got large, a little out of proportion or out of control, I guess I'd say. But yeah, I tried to, the engineer in me tried to make it organized.
Did your parents rock climb, or were they more like mountaineer, kind of like bigger scrambling objectives?
So they did rock climb. 5'8" or so was their max. But back in the day, back in the 70s, doing, you know, the North Ridge of, say, the Grand Teton or something, that's a major undertaking back then. And so, I mean, it still is. But so that was their max, was like 5'7".
There's no totems.
No. Yeah. I have their old climbing gear, and it's just a bunch of, you know, nuts and stoppers and hexes and...
Yeah, it works, but it's definitely different, you know. That's it's a different endeavor to be climbing on that.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, yeah. I have my mom's old EB climbing shoes, which they still work.
Do you climb in them sometimes?
Mm-hmm. What's that?
Have you climbed in them, like, nostalgically?
I did one climb. So I did a climb a cemetery spire in the Grand Tetons, maybe like 10 years ago. Wearing all of my mom's old climbing gear, and just kind of, they had climbed that route, and we were trying to recreate some of the photos that they had from that route, and just the summit photo of wearing the same clothes, and it was fun.
Nice. That's really cool.
Yes, I've worn them once. Now they are a bookend on my bookshelf.
Nice.
I feel like we haven't even really gotten into your story, and I'm already in awe. Like, even just the like inception of your parents meeting and stuff. It's so fascinating, and especially like you know, like I'm born in '93, and like, you know, my generation, I'm sure, like, it's like, people you don't really see, or at least maybe this is just like my own ignorance, or just, you know, the people around me, but you don't really see relationships like that. Like, obviously back in the day, people had like, you know, they got married a lot faster, like things like that happened. But that's just such a unique and like unbelievable story of meeting and kind of this like mountain family. It's just, it's really cool. It's almost like a climbing fairy tale, you know, like I feel like that's like the beginning of a movie I would see or something. So yeah, it's pretty amazing and pretty cool to see. So you said you were going, you're climbing, you're going through the Cascades and stuff. You know, what happened next in your story?
Okay, so yeah, that is a part of the story. So in the Cascades, you know, I was having a lot of adventures, getting out in the mountains a lot, and I think, yeah, it's 2009, I believe, I was climbing the north side, I think the Stoddard Buttress of Mount Terror in the Picket Range, and we were simul-climbing, and my partner pulled off a giant rock and proceeded to fall, break his femur, had a head wound, and that escalated into a 5-day epic on the wall for one of us. We had a group of four up there, and so we left Jason with Steve. Steve was the one who fell. We left Jason with him, and Don and I went to the summit, and we got a phone call out from the summit. There's one bar service up there, and we were able to get a helicopter in, and they plucked Steve off the mountain, short hauled him off, but they didn't have time to get Jason. And so Jason was uninjured at the time, but they gave him they threw him a sleeping bag and some survival gear and said, we'll be back. And weather moved in, and they couldn't come back for 5 days. And so yeah, that's a long time to be out there. And it didn't look like the weather was going to improve in 5 days either. And so that was a very intense experience, I think, for all of us, you know, knowing Jason was up there and this whole thing had gone down. Steve was already in the hospital, had surgery, was doing okay, and looked like he'd recover. And he did recover fully. And so after 5 days, they did manage to get the helicopter in there and got Jason out. And so everything went well, every full recovery for everyone involved. But I think mentally, it probably affected all of us. And so that was just the first experience for me. And 2 years later, I had my own accident in the North Cascades, again from rockfall. I pulled off a giant block and got a tib-fib compound fracture way up on the north face of Vesper. And a very similar story. So similar that my sister, who was climbing with me, she had to go to the summit of Vesper to get out of a phone call. So she left me on the wall there. And the helicopter came in, short hauled me off, and then brought me to the hospital. And, you know, they did all the surgeries and reconstructed my leg. And that was a long recovery. And it didn't look good for a while. I had multiple complications of that tib-fib fracture with compartment syndrome and then a MRSA infection and a severed nerve. And it just didn't look good. And it was about 3 months in where I could move my toe. And then it was like the world opened up again. I was like, I'm going to get back. I'm going to walk. I'm going to run. I'm going to climb again. And from there on, it was just focused on recovery. And I did. I got back to everything, 110%, really. But mentally, that I think was the last, you know, it was enough to cause fear and apprehension. And I was just never the same in the Cascades. I was always a little worried about the loose rock, and I began to think about moving elsewhere. And so fast forward to now I'm living in Estes Park, Colorado. So there's a story behind that too, but you had a question for me?
Yeah, I'm just, I like a couple things, just like with the initial incident with like Steve and stuff, like something that I find that's so, I would say it's unique to climbing is where do you have, you know, I was talking with my partner Ray, and we were talking the other day. I think it's Hillary Nielsen. If it's not her last name, I'm so sorry. But Hillary Nielsen and Jim Morrison, they're like professional massive skiers, and she was skiing Manaslu, I think, and she died in an avalanche. And Jim Morrison is now skiing again still. And we were kind of remarking on this about how it's, and he has quite a tragic history as well with like losing his family and stuff in a plane crash. And I was just remarking that it's so interesting that you would think like, okay, you know, maybe as an outsider looking at climbing, okay, this crazy traumatic incident happens. Like, why? Like, okay, you're done. You know, like climbing's over. You're not going to go out. Like, your friend almost died, or you almost died, or something. Like, climbing's done. Why would you want to go do this? Why would you want to go re-experience this again? And there's just this, you know, I think there's a quote actually you have from your website, which is right. It's like, you know, mountains are in my blood. And it's like, there's just this, like this pull of being in the mountains. It's like, it's weird. It's almost doesn't matter how bad it gets. There's this just desire that like to feel fulfilled in life, you have to go out there. And I just think there's something so fascinating about that. But I'm wondering, like, from the initial incident with Steve, like, were you already really struggling? And how far after did your second accident happen?
I think my second accident happened the next year. I think it was the next summer. And it was so fortunate in so many ways that the accident with Steve had happened, because I'm not sure we would have followed the same process that we did for my own injury. I had gotten to the habit of bringing a phone, and I had never brought a phone out before Steve's accident, because the service in the Cascades wasn't all that great, but Verizon did have coverage from the tops of some summits. And so I got into the habit of bringing one, and we had brought one on Vesper. And without that phone, I'm pretty sure I would have lost my leg, if not my life. Jenny would have had to go much further to go get help. She would have had to go all the way out, and it would have been the next day before they got me off, and that it wasn't good. I'd severed an artery, so I think there were so many little factors from Steve's accident that played into making my own rescue just kind of textbook.
Yeah. So I want to dive a little bit deeper into both these accidents, because you definitely kind of like which I, you know, I appreciate in a way, just kind of like nonchalantly rolled right through, you know, probably some of the most traumatic situations that people can find themselves in. With the first injury, you know, you said he broke his femur. Was it a compound fracture?
No.
Like, what was the severity of the situation? Did he pass out? Like, kind of paint the picture a little bit more personally in terms of how you viewed it in the moment, and what the, you know, energy of everybody was, and the decisions you'd have to make, and the judgment calls that were kind of involved in that kind of accident.
Right. So he ended up kind of beside me when he stopped falling. We were simul-climbing, and I think his last piece had pulled out with the rock. And so just the way things that worked out, he ended up about beside me, flipped over, head down. There was blood. A fair bit coming out of his head area, and it turned out it was a nosebleed, but I didn't know. I was the only one right there at that moment. Jason and Steve were below us by a good pitch or so. And so I was like, well, I gotta get him flipped over head first, head up. Head can't be down. So kind of manhandled him over, kind of propped him on a ledge, tied him in with the rope. That was also an issue, because the rope was one half was severed completely, and I had no idea what was going on with the other half of the rope up there. It could just, you know, I was like, well, it could snap at any moment, and then we're both kind of not really attached to anything at that point. So my priority was just to kind of get him anchored in some way. And so I used, you know, just there was loose rope, and so I used some loose rope that was in the system to anchor him in, and some gear that we had. And then just kind of called out to Jason and Steve, or Jason and Don below, and said, we've we need help here. And so they got up there, and then the three of us assessed the situation and just kind of immediately made a plan. There was no real debate. It was just like, okay, this is what we're going to do. This is what we have to do. We're going to leave one of us. And Jason had some first aid training, and it's like, we're going to leave one of us with Steve here, and we've got a cell phone. We know we get a signal from the top because the previous day we'd gotten a signal from the top of Inspiration, which is a nearby peak. And or the previous trip, I believe, not the previous day. So the previous trip, we'd gotten a signal from the top of a nearby peak. So we knew we could. And so we're like, okay, Don and Steph going to go to the top, get a cell phone call, you know, call 911 and get patched through to the helicopter rescue team in some way. And we were familiar with that being a thing. I'm not quite sure how, but we did know that the North Cascades National Park had helicopters that could rescue. And that's what we did.
Did you, how, what kind of was your situation on the wall? Like, how many feet above the ground were you? How far was it to the top?
I'd say it was maybe 1,000 more feet to the top or so. Mm-hmm. We were probably halfway up the route.
Wow.
Like, you know, it's five, eight or so is the, okay, the hardest the route gets. Okay. But it was fairly steep where we were, but it is ledgy terrain. So mm-hmm. It was no problem finding a ledge for Steve and Jason to sit on. Okay. And it was definitely necessary to leave someone with Steve. He was not quite conscious, and when he would come into consciousness, he would try to unrope. He would try to untie himself, and he wasn't quite sure what was going on, didn't really know where he was, and so
wow,
couldn't scary. Leave him like that. So
he was concussed, yeah. Obviously, right? Like, badly concussed,
he
it
was.
Sounds like.
Yeah. He was, and it had a fair amount of blood in his head area, but fortunately, it was just a nosebleed and a concussion, but nothing more than that. We knew the leg was broken. It didn't look good, but it also wasn't compound. So
was it two parties of two simul-climbing is what you're doing? Like, mm-hmm. You weren't caterpillaring,
yes.
Up, right? Okay, yeah.
Two parties of two simul-climbing.
Okay, interesting. Do you use like microtraction or any type of like rope clamp or anything like that to like protect the second, or were you're just, you know, moving?
Well, I do these days, okay. And perhaps that incident was one of the things that caused me to think more about using those. It wouldn't have done anything for that particular fall. I was not pulled up. Nothing went incorrect with the whole system there.
Yeah.
But I think having a follower fall is a major concern. Microtracks are very useful to increasing the safety of simul-climbing. But no, at the time we were not using them.
Gotcha. And are you and Steve, like, do you still communicate? You still friends to this day?
Well, I have, you know, maybe once per year. We email back and forth just briefly.
On the anniversary.
Just keep in touch. Yeah, I mean, he lives in Washington still, and now I live in Colorado. But we've definitely kept in touch, and he's doing well. You know, 100% recovery.
Awesome. And how about Jason? Out of curiosity, because, you know, obviously, like, the focus seems to be like, you know, Steve. He had the fall; it's serious. But, you know, being benighted for 5 days on the side of a peak in a storm seems like that almost like from a like you know, somatic, like physically, like you maybe endured less trauma or damage, but like that's not, I wouldn't be very happy with that situation, you know, like that's a lot to go through. No, psychologically,
I mean, his story is almost more unique and crazy than Steve's in a way. Yeah, being up there that long, I can't imagine just how you spend your time, what you're thinking, not knowing. I mean, he had a radio, so he was able to communicate, which is probably saved his life. Without that radio communicate, even if they still had come in 5 days, he would have not known. And, you know, giving up hope or maybe trying to self-rescue when you're kind of at that point physically incapable. And after a couple of days, he said he was so stiff and weak that, you know, self-rescue was probably not a safe option at that point.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, just trying to solo out of there, right?
Yeah.
And the weather wasn't great. If the weather had been great and it was on the, you know, the first morning afterwards, he probably could have soloed out of there and, you know, no big deal. But as it was, he's stuck up there in a small cave in bad weather. I can't imagine the mental battle that was going on, but
Has he spoken about it at all? Have you talked with him?
I haven't talked to him much about it. No, but I know he has spoken. I think he was interviewed about it. I can't think of a better member of our team to have to go through that and come out. Just go through it in the best way. I think I would have gone bonkers and tried to do something dangerous, like get out of there, which, you know, wasn't probably not the best decision. And yeah, I can't speak for Don or Steve what they would have done, but Jason has he's a very mellow personality, just really thoughtful, and he probably realized the best thing to do was just to wait.
Wow, yeah, I think I would have gone insane. I would have had like a panic attack and like, you know, not knowing what to do. Just, yeah, I think there's so many things, so many things in life when it's the not knowing, you know, when you don't, when you don't know the outcome, whether that's like through a surgery or a trauma or a situation, like that's so hard to deal with, you know, and to come to terms with, and like, do I act? Do I not act? And you're just sitting there and stewing and ruminating in your own kind of, you know, mental anguish. It's really difficult to do. Not that I know remotely what he went through, but yeah, it's really, really interesting.
There was a lot of that going on the ground too. Like, do we start hiking in there? The weather wasn't great, but it's at some point, do we send in a ground team? Or do we just try to wait until the weather's good and pluck him out of there, which is probably the safer thing to do and the shorter thing to do, because it's quite a ways in there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this, the clock is ticking kind of thing.
With your personal situation and your injury, you know, it sounds like you were in a similar situation where very far off the ground, you know, very remote. Talk to us a little bit about kind of what went through your head.
Well, the crazy thing about it was my sister's first alpine climb. My parents had been encouraging us for a couple of years.
sorry to laugh.
Steph,
welcome
take
to the
Jenny
sport.
Out. Yeah, I know. You should
I process
Jenny
dark
out
things
and,
as humor.
You
just,
you guys
know.
Should do a climb together. Wow. And so we were like, well, Vesper, the North Face, you know, it's 5'7", 5'8". Fairly tame route, you know, nice, fun day, good weather. Everything's good. So we got up there and this happens. And so then Jenny has to, you know, basically make her own anchors, rappel down to the glacier below, which she had done a lot of mountaineering and hiking and stuff. But as far as making her own anchors and doing all that stuff on her own, I think she had very little experience. And she managed to rappel down a few times, you know, leave gear, or she's also very thrifty and she didn't want to leave gear. So she's like wrapping off of trees and like boulders, and she got down. And Jenny has since become a very prolific and excellent climber. So she's just got it in her blood too. So she did everything right, got down there and ran up to the summit, got the phone call out, and then hiked out with my stuff and her stuff, and got my car. I'd given her my key, and so she drove my car home. And as she was going home, she called my parents, and so then they found out. And meanwhile, I'm on the mountain there, and so I did know when she got the phone call out. There was a couple hours there where I had no idea what was going on. So Jenny's left. I don't know where she is. I'm hoping she's safe. I knew she was going through rugged terrain, and my leg's not looking good. It's bleeding. We had an ice axe, and we had taken my crampon straps and the ice axe and created a makeshift splint on my leg and kind of elevated it in a tree, wrapped it with a fleece, and just kind of hoped for the best with that. Did seem to have stopped bleeding, so that was good. And I wasn't in shock, strangely enough. That could have been bad if I'd been in shock about it. I could have passed out and not been able to see the helicopter when it eventually did come or any of that. But I wasn't. I was actually in a state of like almost boredom, which is very strange, but in a way it helped me.
What kind of pain were you in? Because you seem like a very stoic person.
It was quite painful, but for some reason, unless it's in my mouth, like a tooth or like anything, I can kind of just shut it off. And so the pain, I don't remember. I do remember thinking, well, this is painful. This is really painful. And then but I don't remember the pain. It wasn't a big deal to me. I, you know, as long as it's not in my mouth, because I've had my fair number of root canals. And the root canals, I remember the pain. But I do not remember the pain in my leg that on the mountain there, which is
near death, no adrenaline. Problem. Toothache, you're done. You get me out of here.
Basically. And that's been pretty much the consistency in my other injuries as well. I can tune out the pain as long as it's not in my mouth.
Wow. Wow. Really amazing.
So yeah, it's fortunate, I guess. But I guess I was in an odd state of boredom. I knew things would be all right, which I don't know why, because yeah, obviously there was a lot that couldn't be all right. I didn't know for sure there was going to be a helicopter coming in that day. They do take a long time to mobilize, and it was early in the day. We do start early, so it was still before noon at the time of the accident. And so I knew I had plenty of time as far as daylight went, but you know, there's time taken getting the helicopter there. And then them seeing you, like how that wasn't a sure thing either. You're on this big rock face, looking down, and how in the world are you going to see someone? And so I was a little worried about that, but kind of knew things were going to turn out all right. So just kind of waited and took pictures and ate some cookies and drank some water. I do remember it all, which is interesting. And then the helicopter came. I heard the blades, and I was like, oh, they're here. Okay, how are they going to see me? And they didn't really have anything they could see me with, you know, just kind of my jacket, which was dark in color, but, you know, waved around, and eventually they did see me, and they sent a guy down on a hoist, I believe is what they called it, and he unclipped and kind of stayed with me, put me in a screamer suit, and then they came back around, and you know, the cable swung in, the guy grabbed it and clipped both of us to it, me with my screamer suit and him with his harness, and then we were just plucked off the mountain, and that was a wild ride. And then they hoisted us up and kind of got me stabilized in the helicopter. And at some point, they probably gave me morphine or something, and I don't remember waking up until the next morning.
Wow. They didn't have any problems with the helicopter, like stalling or crashing or anything like that?
No, but that's, I later actually ended up joining that helicopter rescue team, the very same team that rescued me. I joined them on some flights and did some photography for them, and just got to learn a bit more about what they do and how they do it. And that is not a safe maneuver to do. Up against the mountains there with the gustiness, and just you don't have too much room with steep walls, and especially the guy that's swinging in, like that's, you got to swing him in as a pilot, you know, gently enough that he doesn't slam into the rock, and that's hard. So that's, those guys do good work, and they're all volunteers, and they're saving lives, but also putting themselves in quite a bit of jeopardy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I was more making a joke as a reference to one of the episodes that we had recorded in the past. There's a gentleman who got airlifted in the helicopter after they got attached to the line, stalled and like fell down the cliff, and they got drugged through the talus before it picked up the air again and pulled them off the wall. Crazy story.
That's crazy,
Crazy story. I can't imagine that happening. If you guys missed that, if anybody listening has missed that episode, definitely check that out. That's with Joshua Reinig.
Yeah, really cool episode. But yeah, in general, it's like you don't think about it, but like, yeah, like, you know, every time you're calling SAR, like there are people risking their lives to come and get you, you know, and it's both like a miracle and unbelievable that there are people to do that. And we're so fortunate for it. But at the same time, like there is a very real cost to that, right? Which is, it's something to not be overlooked lightly. I was going to ask if you were like kind of cognizant to like the seriousness of your state, but it sounds like you were pretty messed up and gone in the hospital, and you're saying you're waking up the next day. And so, yeah, I'm guessing not.
I was very aware of how messed up I was, and I was bummed out that I thought I would never run again and climb again. I was already going through all this in my head. And yeah, it's interesting your comment from earlier about, you know, why don't you just stop climbing? But the first thing I was thinking, even on the wall, was, oh, I really want to be able to climb again. I hope this is not the end of my days in the mountains. This is awful. You know.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's just such a testament to just, I don't even know, like, maybe this sounds wonky, but it's like, it's almost like some kind of form of like spiritual awakening or religion, or, you know, some kind of like, it's like the mountains are my church. It's like, I need it in my life to like feel fulfilled and for my mind to be like clear and to feel just like present and content as a human being. Like, I have to do it. So it's like, it doesn't matter how bad it got. I mean, granted, I'm sure on some level, if it got bad enough, like, you know, I haven't experienced that, so I don't obviously can't put myself in that situation. But like, it feels at least like that it's like, it doesn't matter about like weighing that. It's like it's almost like I have to do it to stay sane or to feel good as a person, right? So yeah, it's just really fascinating. Yeah. that's a really interesting one, identifying as a climber and outdoor person, for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that certain injuries can strip that away from you, and then there is an identity crisis. I kind of went through it a little bit. It's like, well, it kind of almost felt like it was off the table for a little bit, and I was like, what do I do now, you know? and it ended up turning into be a good thing. It diversified my skill set and started practicing other areas of my life, so it ended up working out for the better. I'm still a climber, but I'm now much more than a climber. I have two questions for you. One, again, the stoicness and like the general boredom that you seemed to have in the moment, do you feel like any of that was suppressed? And did you feel like it came out later in your life in other areas in how you dealt with things? Or was it just straight up, you kind of just like were flatlining during that moment and it just kind of was what it was?
Well, I'd say that's just the way I am. When things get really rough, I tend to just kind of kick into gear and forget about how rough they are and just do what needs to be done. So I'd say that part of the whole thing, there, I don't sense any trauma or anything that's continued from that into life now. I'd say it was more the recovery and some of the unknowns that went on and the unexpected things that went on during the recovery that, and just the long-term nature of the recovery taking me out of climbing for so long, that has carried into right now. Like, I will be just cragging and leading some sport climb and 2 feet above a bolt and going, oh, I don't want to fall and break a leg because I don't want to face another 2-year recovery.
Yeah, okay.
So that definitely affects me every time I climb. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I ever really think about the life-threatening bit on the wall.
You can't really. I don't think you can. I think that if you do too much, one, it takes away from the fun and the presentness of the experience, and also doesn't make you as good of a climber because you're thinking about how you can die and not how you're presently climbing. So it is an interesting thing to be, you know, I think in the beginning days before injury as a climber, it's this blissful ignorance, you know, you don't really know what it's like to get injured. You don't know what it's like to lose a friend, or it's just fun. Everything's great. You know, you take a fall and you get caught and you're like, wow, that was sick. You know, that was amazing. You know, the trad is amazing because it works. And then, you know, everything comes crashing down and the reality of injury and death just gets thrown in your face. And it's this kind of other chapter of climbing where you have to try to have the same amount of presence and focus and skill while having the reality just like right there at the forefront of your mind. It's like stuff. And I think that some people can be super successful and not get injured and just stay in that kind of blissful state their entire life and not really completely understand what it's like. And God bless those people, but there's another stage to it. After your injury, you blew out your knee as well.
There was like a helicopter rescue.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that was 2020. I had been living in Colorado at that point for a couple of years. I came here for grad school, and I was, we're climbing in the Rocky Mountain National Park, climbed this route called Goldfinger on Arrowhead, and got to the summit. All was good, great day, great climb. And I'd snapped a photo and texted my parents, because you do get a signal from the top of Arrowhead, and texted my parents with a nice little photo of the great weather from the summit. And then I was hopping from one boulder to the next to try to catch up with my partner. And the boulder shifted a little bit and I missed the next one. And I just went down. My knee just buckled. And I was like, that didn't feel like that was in the right place at all. And I was like, but wait, it doesn't hurt. I'm good. I'm going to stand up. And I tried to stand up and it just collapsed on me. And it's
oh my God.
It's like, okay, that really wasn't supposed to do that. And so I called to my partner, and he was able to hear me and he came back. And at that point, I tried again to put weight on it, and it just wasn't taking weight. And it's like, well, at this point, I think it probably just, you know, ACL. That seems like what happened here. And it felt starting to feel quite painful. And so we splinted it up and I crawled half a mile along the summit ridge to the descent route. There's a rappel descent route. And my partner lowered me, and you know, I proceeded to be lowered and crawl and lowered and crawl all the way back to camp. And meanwhile, we had on the summit ridge, we were discussing, okay, are we going to self-rescue from camp? It's a good, you know, 6 miles or so, half of which is kind of rugged. Going to self-rescue, crawl out, or going to call in the search and rescue team? You know, the idea of self-rescuing is much more appealing as a climber. Yeah, I don't like to call in an army again. But it was apparent that I was pretty bad off. And self-rescuing probably would have been quite difficult and might have gotten quite hurt at some point with the rugged terrain. So we did make a phone call and got the Rocky Mountain search and rescue team, the ground team, to come in because it wasn't life-threatening or anything, and to see if they could get me out of there. And they got there that evening and stayed with us overnight in our bivvy cave and decided that given, you know, how bad my knee was looking at that point and the ruggedness of the terrain, that a helicopter rescue was in order. Another one. So it ended up, because of the rugged terrain, they brought in a military helicopter the next day, a Blackhawk, and they were able to hoist me out of there. And yep, I got to the Estes Park Hospital and got the MRI and everything, and it was a pretty bad knee injury. It was an ACL. It was a multiple tears in the meniscus. I had broken some, you know, contusions, I think, in the bones because of the force of hitting it. There were a couple cartilage areas that were damaged. It didn't look good. It looked like a pretty blown out knee, like a career ender if you're a professional athlete. And I was like, oh boy, here we go again. Climbing's over.
Yeah.
But
so that was 10 years apart from your broken tib fib incident. Is that correct?
Yep. Pretty much exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So I guess, you know, I think Kyle kind of alluded to this at the beginning, but like, you know, there seems to be, like, obviously for anybody listening, you can go to Steph's website and she has a really detailed report of what happened through her tib fib. And it's quite literally an ultra marathon of pure suffering and recovery and surgery. And, you know, it's really unbelievable. And so do that. And then to come back and to kind of have this kind of injury, you know, what was like that recovery process? What do you find is like the driving force for you to just, you know, to just really just jump back on the horse and to just kind of get through these incidents? Because they're really major incidents. Like each one, right, could definitely take somebody out.
Because I want to get back to climbing. I want to get back into the mountains, and I want to not suffer in the mountains. So I need to be strong and fit and not in pain and not limping around. And yeah, also, I think for me, I'm both goal oriented and process oriented, I guess. And I like having something to do that really furthers my progress. And so I would just dive wholeheartedly into the physio, both injuries. And apart from those two injuries, I don't really do physio. Physio is magic if you just keep doing it, keep not overdoing it, but not underdoing it, finding that sweet spot and just making it, you know, the thing you're, for me, I was able to make it the thing my life revolved around both times for a good 6 months to a year, depending on the injury. Since as a student, both times that was possible. And yeah, I think the driving motivation was just to get back to climbing, get back into the mountains. Yeah.
So you're a student during these moments. For real quick, I want to say all three accidents were because of loose rock, right? It sounds like that.
I guess I haven't really thought about the third one as being loose rock, but yes.
It's a loose boulder, yeah.
The boulder shifted as I jumped from one to the other and I missed.
And you moved away from Washington away from to get it. Away from okay. loose rock and it followed you.
Yeah.
Be careful.
Everywhere.
My other question besides the joke there is, you know, we talk about in our injury podcast, we talk a little bit about the financial aspect of injuries and how detrimental it can be. You know, obviously Max and I are in different countries, and so there's a bit of discrepancy there. You know, multiple helicopter evacuations, you know, full spectrum of a rescue there. You're a student, you know, if you feel comfortable, do you mind talking to us a little bit about kind of how that impacted your life? If it did, you know, were you on scholarship through school? You know, cause you are very, you know, accomplished in the academic field. And, you know, most people that are as accomplished as you find themselves in, you know, six figure debt, you know, and to have, you know, academic debt like that on top of any sort of medical bills would just be devastating. Financially. So, you know, maybe shed some light on kind of what the situations looked like in a financial perspective.
Sure. I think I got lucky in being a student both times. So the first time, the tib fib, I was at UW. I was working on my PhD at UW. And I was on student health insurance, which I really had no real clue of how much things would cost back then. And a student plan, you know, just looked plenty sufficient at the time. But I ended up owing the hospital about $300,000 or so. And my maximum payout, my maximum benefit, I believe that's what they call it, was $100,000. So it was $200,000 that I needed to pay the hospital. And I could not, as a student, did not have that money. But because I was a student, I was able to apply for charity care and got a little lucky in that case. And instead of having to file for medical bankruptcy and having, you know, my entire savings account wiped out, I was able to get through that one on charity care because I didn't really have an income. I didn't have much for them to take. But it also solidified for me the importance as a climber of getting a catastrophic medical plan, something that's going to cover more than $100,000, because $100,000 is going to go very quickly if you're in the hospital for multiple days. So I was in the hospital for a grand total of like 21 days overnight, 21 overnight days. Wow. And that will just, in intensive care, will really increase your bill. So yeah. I got lucky in that one. And the second one, the knee injury, again, I was on a student healthcare plan, and that one wasn't nearly as expensive because of no overnights in the hospital. Yeah, no overnights in the hospital. And it was mainly just the major knee surgery that needed to be done. And that was covered under my student plan.
Mm. Wow.
So
it's,
I got
fortunate.
Fortunate, yeah. If I'd been working full time and not a student for the first one, it could have potentially been quite bad. Which, you know, the American medical system has its flaws, but also has its great things. I mm-hmm. feel like in both cases, I got just great care, great surgeons who kind of made all the difference in my ability to use my leg and my knee right now. No complaints at all. And I'd pay all that money twice over to have what I have now.
Yeah.
Be able
yeah,
to 100%. Use my body for the rest of my life.
Yeah. I think that's, there's, I think like Dave Huberman and Peter Attia, they're these podcasters if you've ever listened to them, but like they talk about a lot of health and wellness. And you know, there's a couple things that you can look at when you're looking at healthcare, and I think one of them is like access, quality, and cost. Like those are kind of like the three mm-hmm. like pillars, right? And I know a lot of people like to comment on the, at least, you know, I'm Canadian, a lot of people like to comment on the US kind of healthcare system. And I think there's problems in healthcare systems everywhere. And it's easy mm-hmm. to point the fingers at things, but like the US definitely has quality. Like you can get right. extremely high quality of care, right? And in certain circumstances, mm-hmm. like that's the difference. Like, you know, reading through your website, it's like, yeah, like you possibly could have, you know, lost your leg, or when you had a MRSA infection, like if you hadn't been treated like well mm-hmm. or correctly, like you could have died. So there's definitely a lot of caveats, I think, to any system. And that's really interesting. I think on your website, you kind of mentioned where you almost felt like it felt maybe, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but my interpretation of it was like, it's like, what's the point of paying for healthcare insurance if I still owe like $200,000 yeah. afterwards, you know? And you're like, on some level, it's kind of funny. Like, I remember this is obviously on such a minute level, and I was like maybe young 20s, like at the time, but someone had tried to break into my truck and they smashed my window. And I found out there's no deductible. Like the deductible for the window is the same as the cost of the window. So right. it's like, I was just like, okay, this is the first thing that I've ever been in an accident for. It's a broken window. I've been paying you guys insurance for like, you know, 5 years. And now you're just telling me you don't cover it. And I was like kind of sitting there being like, what the hell is this? Like, this is ridiculous, you know? And my like, naivety is like, you know, in my young 20s. So
that's when you think about taking your car and driving it off the cliff and be like, well, I don't know what happened.
yeah, then they'll cover. Like, you just give you a new car.
Exactly, yeah. exactly.
Yeah, yes. I remember at the time it was quite frustrating at times to be pretty laid up dealing with a bone infection and the same day getting these bills in the mail that they're going to come collect. And it's just like, I don't want to deal with this now. Shouldn't mm-hmm. I be covered for all this? Like, this is something I can't deal with right now. And so, yeah, it was frustrating at the time. Now that I can look back at it and it all worked out, and it's definitely worth any money I paid to mm-hmm. have the help I got. But yeah, I do wonder sometimes, okay, I pay for insurance, but yet they make it so hard to get the money from them, and you're not in the state at that point to be really fighting for yourself. It's just the last thing you have the energy for. And so, yeah, that is frustrating when you're dealing yeah. with it.
I think another one that I thought interesting from reading was it's like, I don't understand, so I don't, once again, want to say too much, but it was like, dependent on the hospital you are at, you get preferential cost and coverage. So it's like, mm-hmm. you could be at a hospital 10 minutes away from the hospital that's like preferential mm-hmm. in your insurance, and like that hospital will cover everything, and this hospital will charge you, you know, out the woo-ha. Yeah. And it's like, as a Canadian, where I'm fortunate in the aspect where I think our quality is lower, but everybody here gets access. It's like, no matter what, you mm-hmm. can get access. And there's a lot of trouble with that system, but it's also really good in certain contexts, right? So I guess for me, it's like, the distinction doesn't matter. It's like, if I'm like closer to this hospital and I go to this hospital, they don't charge me 10 times the amount right. of this hospital than the one like, you know, closer to my house or something, which just seems like such a bizarre way to just, lack of a better word, fuck people over, you know, like, yeah so it's interesting.
I remember they did fly me to a hospital that was out of network. And I remember Whoa. That being such a big deal in the first week. And I was pretty laid up, but my parents were kind of going to bat for me, you know. It's out of network, but this is an emergency situation. So, you know, calling the insurance company, making sure that they'll cover it. And I think the lesson I learned is that if you fight for yourself, you often do win. Mm-hmm. You just have to fight hard. Mm-hmm. And it's not a thing you want to be doing in the moment. It's easy to say, well, you know, I'm just going to give into it and pay them the money. And this is what they're asking for. And it is what it is. But I think there is an ability to fight. It's a frustrating fight, but
I think ironically, it's there. I've had experiences here in Canada where it's kind of similar, actually. Like, if you just leave yourself to the whims of the system, you can get like, you can fall through the cracks, or things mm-hmm. happen really slow. But like, if you like fight and advocate for yourself, you can make things happen. Like, I remember when I broke my ankles, and they were like, oh yeah, we can see you in several days or whatever. And I was like, absolutely not. Like, give me a list of surgeons. Like, I'm going to start calling their office, talking to them. And you can get an appointment quicker if you actually are willing to take things into your own hand, like have agency and start fighting for yourself. So yeah, that's an interesting parallel. Sorry that I just think of. Yeah.
No, it's a good point, because I think people need to know that. Some people don't know that, and it's just worth knowing. It is worth fighting for.
I just think that's true in everything. I think business, sales, every aspect of your life. Like, if you're not an advocate for yourself, and you don't have a clear vision for what you deserve as a human, or do you deserve in a relationship, whether that be a business relationship, if you're not advocating for yourself, no one's going to do it for you. It's not their priority. You know, you have to advocate for yourself. And I think that people respect that, because, you know, it puts your needs in front of them, and you're like, hey, this is how you can help me. Please do it. You know, this is kind of like expected almost. But if you don't say anything, no one's going to go out of their way to help you out. And I don't think that's wrong. I don't think that it's like their job to advocate for you, unless, you know, it's a lawyer or something. But in general, I think it's your job to advocate for yourself on a day-to-day basis.
I think whether it's a doctor, it's a lawyer, it's the insurance company, like, people are just human, you know, and even the best make mistakes, or they have bad days, or they're tired, or they have a bandwidth. And, you know, if you have a whole pile of stuff to do, that's different than like, hey, this person emailed me 3 times today, you know, and they keep asking about this same thing. And you're like sitting there looking at your inbox. You're like, oh shit. Like, I've got to deal with this thing. You know, it's like, it just creates precedent. And unfortunately, like it sometimes just can be the reality of things. So, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, moving along here, you know, there's been so much, again, you know, a testament to just how much you've accomplished, and, you know, how much life you've lived, you know, in these 39 years. I think you've lived more than, you know, probably 6 or 7 people combined in certain situations, which is pretty impressive. You know, one thing that we wanted to cover here is, you know, you made a pretty strong decision to leave the Cascades and to move to Colorado. Now you're in Estes Park. You know, talk to us a little bit about that journey in your mind and what kind of pushed you along to finally end up where you're at now.
Right. So, yeah, I'd lived in Bellingham for a good 8 years, which was the longest I had lived anywhere in one single stretch. I went to grad school at Western Washington there, and then was hired on as a adjunct math teacher, and I was happy and teaching and loving it. But the clouds and the rain and the lack of year-round climbing was starting to bug me a bit. And, you know, I was starting to think, okay, so where can... I'm single. I really have no major ties. As an adjunct, I'm looking for a career rather than to stay as an adjunct forever. And so I started to think, where could I find a life for myself? And so I'm starting to think of all the mountain town areas. You know, there's Bishop, there's let's see, blanking here, Red Rocks, Las Vegas is also a key contender. It's not really a mountain town, but the climbing, I love Red Rocks. And so that was on the list. There was, Boulder made the list. Estes Park definitely made the list. And so, let's see, one other place, Bozeman also made the list. And so I had gone to all these places, and, Estes Park was the one where I just remember going, boy, if I could live in a place like that, then I would have made it. That is my life goal. I had first gone to Estes Park in 2007, and just for a couple days, climbed the Petit Grappin, just kind of bummed around in town, walked around, and just kind of enthralled by the area. And that stuck in my mind. And then I'm back in Bellingham, and Estes Park is making the list. And it didn't really seem feasible just to move to Estes Park. Yeah, I didn't really have a job there. There was no real, there was no reason for me to go there. And it would be hard to just establish a life there. And so I came up with the compromise of Boulder because they had a university. And I thought, well, this is a great opportunity to go get that PhD finally. So I did mention previously that I've been working on a PhD at UW, but then I'd broken my leg, and that did end the PhD for me at that point. I just didn't have the drive for it after that whole experience. So, I was like, okay, now I'm going to do my PhD. And so I applied to CU Boulder, got accepted, applied math program, and moved down there in 2019 and just loved it. Living in Boulder, climbing in Eldo, flat irons, and in the summer making trips to the Rocky Mountain National Park and climbing bigger things there, multi-pitch stuff there, and just falling in love with the area and spending a lot of time in Estes Park in the meantime. So I was offered a job shortly after I finished my master's in applied math. This was last year, so May 2022. I was offered a job working at a remote methane gas monitoring company based in Boulder. They're called Longpath Technologies. And I had to kind of make a decision. Do I continue my PhD or do I take this job, which sounds really quite good? This might be a good career move for me. And I took the job. And that also allowed me to start to think, well, do I want to stay in Boulder or can I now move to Estes Park? And the idea kind of grew. And within 6 months of starting the job, I was looking and placing an offer on a house in Estes Park. And I ended up, getting the house. And so I moved in about 2 months ago or so to Estes Park. First house I've ever bought, and I love it. It's a little small home overlooking the town with a view of Long's Peak, and it's just great. It's kind of, I feel like I've made it, but I know that there are several years ahead. I'm kind of excited to be here and be surrounded by the mountains that I've grown to love. And I do work remotely, so that's worked out really well that I can now have just a mountain office.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
I got a cat a few weeks ago, and so really settling in.
Is his name's Newt, right?
Yeah.
His name is Newton. named after Isaac Newton.
I was going to say, yeah.
calculus. my math background.
Very
fitting. Yeah, he's actually right here next to me, so.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I've got a cat, Tigger. He's on the couch in the Tigger. Back there. I don't know if you guys there you can get him in the corner there. Yeah. He's just sleeping back there by all the climbing ropes. And Kyle's got his
I've got two cats, Roof and Poof.
Nice. cats are great little creatures.
100%. I think they liven up the home. They feel so good. I've lived with cats my whole life. I love cats. Yeah, they're so great.
Yeah.
I know there's some like certain behemoth, like fervor old dog lovers listening to this right now who are like, foaming at the mouth. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Sorry, guys. Dogs are good too. It's not like not a competition here. I just like cats a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, Estes Park sounds really amazing. Sounds like such a cool place and really interesting to be there. And obviously, if you're looking at Long's Peak and stuff, I'm wondering, did you ever climb any of the volcanoes back in the Cascades, like Rainier, Baker? Did you do any of those classic mountaineering routes?
I did. Yeah, I kind of got into a phase where I wanted to do all the volcanoes. And so I did Rainier by three different routes, I believe. Started off with Disappointment Cleaver and then ended up doing Liberty Ridge and Ptarmigan Ridge back to back. So within a week, we'd done both. And that was pretty cool.
That's awesome.
And I'd done Baker by a couple different routes, the North Face being the one I remember the most. And I think the other one we did was just the Coleman Deming, the standard route that we come down. And Shuckson as well was a good one. It's not a volcano, but yeah, I really enjoyed that North Face route.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And as far as other volcanoes, I did Helens. That's a pretty easy one.
Nice.
It's much shorter than it used to be, so it's much easier as well. Yeah. My parents had done had climbed to the top of Helens before it had blown its top. And
whoa, you know, no way.
More. Yeah.
Yep. I think wow. It, yeah, when did it blow? 1980s?
I think so.
Somewhere around
like
there.
That.
So they had climbed it when it was still... They were actually in the mountains backpacking, spending the night somewhere in the mountains when Mount St. Helens blew, and they have this wild story of ash just blowing everywhere and not having any idea what had happened, thinking it was
wow.
a nuclear war, and end up being Mount St. Helens.
That's wild. So.
That
my
must have been wild.
My a previous boss of mine, like he I think he was like graduating from high school at the time or something, and they were like drunk partying, and like I think it was like a Soyuz, I'm pretty sure, and like when St. Helens had exploded, they had woken up and their cars were like covered in ash and everything. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's in Canada.
Crazy.
It's like, it's quite an unbelievable explosion. So mm-hmm. yeah, I wonder if there was anybody climbing on the mountain the day it went off, you know.
I don't know.
Yeah, we'll never know, probably.
Nope.
they're part of the mountain now. I'm wondering, like, what are your like long-term kind of like climbing aspirations or hopes? Like, what are you looking at and envisioning for yourself as a climber? Like, what motivates you? What inspires you? What do you want to do?
Well, I have a lot of objectives in the Rocky Mountain National Park, of course. You know, various routes that I haven't yet done or want to do again because they're great. It's the stuff on the Diamond, routes on Spearhead, Arrowhead. Just local objectives and just basically getting out and enjoying life. I'm no elite climber, so I have no ambitions of climbing anything super hard or super new or anything like that. I just kind of want to enjoy the mountains and climbing. So no real like specific goals mm-hmm. other than volume and getting out as many days as I can. And I think as I'm getting older, I'm tending to think more towards, you know, traverses again, like in the picket range that I used to do. But now that I'm getting older and it might be coming back as something I want to do more of. So to link up several peaks in a row overnight, you know, traverse through the entire park kind of thing.
Yeah.
And further. So I've been looking more into that kind of stuff.
And super cool.
Of course, photography. I always like documenting things. I can't help it. And so creating something unique and adventurous so that I can document is definitely an appeal to me.
Yeah.
Motivates me.
So my question here is based around all that you've accomplished. I think that, you know, in life, there is always a give and take. You know, there are sacrifices that we make to achieve the things that we mm-hmm. decide to make time for. Do you feel like there are any standout sacrifices that you made in your life to live the life that you live now? Are there areas of your life that, you know, that you have consciously kind of like put aside or chosen to set on the back burner at all? Or have you just been living exactly how you want to live and there hasn't been much sacrifice?
I'm not sure there's been much sacrifice, but I'm very hard on myself, and I would never say that I think I'm living my life exactly the way I want to live. I always want to, and I never feel like I'm doing enough, which is, I know you said I've done enough for a few lifetimes, but I feel like I just never feel like I've done enough. Like if I don't go out climbing once a week, I'm like, what am I doing with myself? I'm not doing anything. but so as far as sacrifices or things, I'm not sure. I mean, I do spend a lot of time alone, and you know, don't have a lot of free time to read books, watch TV, just play video games. Like, those things are not really a part of my life. They're not really something I really desire. I mm-hmm. would rather just be exercising or you know, working so that I can get out on the weekend, or, you know, actually out in the mountains. So my social life maybe has suffered, but again, I'm kind of content to be entertaining myself a lot. So I'm not sure that's a sacrifice. It's just kind of played into how I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's cool. I wasn't trying to like make a negative spin out of it by any means.
No.
I just think that, you know, that's one of the things that I struggle with sometimes personally for me is like choosing where to spend my time, you know, because there's so much that we can do in our life and so little time.
I'd say I never feel like I have enough time, which, it's like, boy, I'd like to read that book, but I don't have time. Yeah, I'd like to sit down and watch a TV show, but that's not happening, you know.
Hey, I don't know. We might all be able to live forever in the next 20, 30 years, so.
Who knows?
That'd be nice.
Yeah, I think something that's interesting for me is a lot of the times, like, people like to compare themselves to other people, or you look at other people and how productive they are and what they're doing, and maybe on some level you have this assumption that, like, oh, they've got it all figured out, or they all feel good. But, like, most people who I see that are, like, hyper successful or very accomplished, like which I would consider you one of those people, like, you, they have the mentality you have where it's like they themselves never feel like it's enough. They're always driven, they're always doing more, they're working more. You know, you seem like really, really humble as a person. And yeah, like it is really, really interesting to see. Something that I found, like, which I honestly, like, keep thinking I'm reading it wrong, but, like, do you have 3 master's degrees?
I do.
Could you explain that to me? I'm sorry. It's just so, like, it's very impressive, and it's also like very interesting. So it's like part of that, like, I'm assuming is like when you did part of your PhD, that's what it is, right? Okay.
It's because I couldn't finish a PhD that I had 3 master's degrees. I love academia. I love learning and school. I'd stay in school. I'd do master's degrees my whole life if I could. It's just enjoyable to learn things to the master's level, and then it starts getting a little miserable. But I got my first master's at UW, and I was working on a PhD in civil engineering, and that PhD definitely would have happened. I had no intent to end it. I was excited to see where it would go, and then I broke my leg shortly after getting my master's in civil engineering there, and I was continuing onwards. And I was out of commission for long enough that I kind of just lost my psych. And also, I did lose money. There was some amount of money that I did have to pay for the medical bills. And I was offered a job at a engineering firm nearby. And it just seemed like, okay, well, this seems like something I should take to earn some money back and then figure out what to do. So that was the end of that PhD. And then I went back to get a second master's in math at Western Washington. That one was never intended to be a PhD because they didn't have a PhD program. But I thought, you know, teaching math would be, that'd be a great way to go. I love math. I love sharing that knowledge. And it worked out quite well. I loved every bit of that master's degree. And then I got hired on, and I could still be there teaching there. There was no end in sight of work to do there, and I was happy and fit in the program quite well. But being an adjunct forever, it's difficult to pay the bills as an adjunct, to be honest. And I kind of wanted to continue in academia, and to get a PhD in math was kind of the goal, so that I could become a professor and teach and actually make enough to live off of and do some research as well. And so that's why I went to CU Boulder to get a PhD in applied math. And I'd say that COVID might have played somewhat of a role in the fact that I ended at a master's. It did change how school was for a good enough time. Classes went remote. All of a sudden, you're disconnected from the campus and from all the people you're working with, and you kind of feel this lack of connection and community. But, plugged onwards, enjoyed the material for sure. And I was planning on continuing that PhD when I was offered a pretty good job. And so I remember at the time thinking, okay, I have a decision to make here. I'm either going to continue the PhD and end up in academia and see where that goes for me, but I probably won't be able to stay in Colorado because it's just hard to get a job working as a professor where you want to work. You got to kind of go somewhere else typically for a while before you get to where you want to be. Certainly the story for my dad and just a lot of people I've known. And so I really wanted to stay in Colorado. And I thought, well, if I if I take this job working for this Long Path Technologies, this methane gas monitoring company, which sounds great, like it's data analysis and it's just kind of research in a way. They're a startup and they're just kind of researching how to do this stuff as they're doing it and perfecting their systems. I was like, this sounds kind of nice. I could stay in Colorado and continue the learning and have an actual job and, you know, make more money than I am as a grad student. And so I decided to take the job and I am still working for them and, you know, definitely no regrets. It's a great company and the work is very interesting. And so, yeah, that's how I ended up with 3 master's degrees and no PhD.
That's awesome, though. I mean, it's obviously unbelievably right. impressive. And yeah, it's really crazy. Like when I was reading through it, I was like, I kept thinking I was making a mistake because it's so unique. Have you ever looked up what the record for most master's degrees is? Slash,
no,
have you considered going for it?
I mean, I would love to go for a 4th, but I feel like I've been fortunate that I've been funded on scholarships through all of them. It has something to do with how, you know, my grades and my performance and how well mm-hmm. I've done. I've gotten scholarships that have funded them, but I don't think they'd fund a 4th. I don't know what kind of case I would have for myself at this point. So I think I made that decision last May. I was like, well, either I'm getting the PhD and staying in academia or I'm exiting now and probably never coming back. And so I made the exit.
That's really cool.
It's another chapter now. Yeah, it's good.
Last one on academia for me at least is like, what's your favorite thing, like maybe most fascinating thing to just like work on or that like interests you the most in what you're doing in like mathematics or engineering?
Calculus. I just love calculus. I think it's so fun. I do tutor calculus on occasion, and I don't know. I just love it. I think it's such a fascinating and cool thing to be able to do with math and quite useful.
Awesome.
Yeah, so I'd say calculus.
Sweet.
I just like doing an integral. I just like sitting down and doing an integral for no point other than doing the integral. So probably very few people that can relate with that. But
yeah, I'm not one of them, but you know, I definitely have an appreciation for it. And it's cool. That's awesome. Good for you.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, wrapping things up here, we're coming kind of to the end. Just want to tie things back to, you know, your website, you know, people to find, you know, who you are, your story. And, you know, I think that the biggest accomplishment, at least I've seen in terms of just effort you've put into this website is with your, what I'm looking for, the route descriptions, the
route overlays.
Route overlays, yeah. And so how many are on there right now? How many routes?
I have no idea.
Yeah, hundreds, right? Or like
probably
close to 100?
I'm sure there's hundreds. I make route overlays for things that don't deserve them because I like making them so much. But
and yeah, I mean, how many climbs do you feel that you have documented on the website in general? Like hundreds of climbs with
hundreds,
like detailed.
Yeah, I mean, I have a weird numbering system that probably only I understand of what merits a number and what doesn't. But I think I'm at like 617 trip reports.
Oh my god!
But I also have a list of how many days I've managed every year, and it's far more than that. And how many climbs? Yeah. It's far more than that. But yeah, you know, certain things will merit trip reports, and there's 617 at this point.
Wow.
So
yeah, I mean, just that in itself as a resource for us climbers and for anybody looking to learn more about these routes, it's just, I just want to point people to it as a resource. You know, the fan that pointed us towards you, that was, you know, what he was so psyched about sharing was the resource of your trip reports and how detailed you were and how committed you were to sharing this information freely. And so, yeah, I just want to, you know, give you a bit of praise for that and just...
Oh, thank you.
Really paint the picture on how much effort that is. You know, I think a lot of people wouldn't take the time to do that so consistently for years and years and years.
Yeah.
And so
I don't even want to think about the hours I've put in, but it's all pure. It's I wouldn't say it's pure enjoyment, but it's almost all enjoyment. I do it for fun. I do love documenting, and the ability to share it, it makes it even better. So.
Do you know like stats on your website? Do you have like a significant amount of traffic?
Yeah, I have a analytics. Google Analytics provides you with all the stats. You can look down into even the cities people are from, so you can see how many page views you get, how long people are spending on each page, how many new users you have, how many repeat users you have, where they're living. Yeah, you can pretty much drill down into anything. Mm-hmm. And I do have a page on my website that summarizes that, website stats page.
okay, cool.
The thing is, I remade my website 2020, like during my knee injury days. I remade my website because Google Sites was closing down its previous sites, and they were just shutting those sites down, and my site was way too big to convert. And so I was in contact with the some of the people, the admins at the Google Sites, and they're like, well, your site, nope, it's not going to convert. You got to remake it. And at that point, it's quite big. This is only a couple of years ago. And so my knee injury days, I spent recreating my website. And I don't think it's as popular anymore because, you know, it takes a while to get to the tops of the searches and stuff. So... when I look at Google Analytics, I don't see as many users, but you know, that's okay with me. It's not my goal. But
are you sponsored or anything? Like, is there any sort of revenue from the website and the traffic?
No revenue. And I don't really, people have asked if I want to put ads on there. And, I personally don't know how much ads revenue you can even get, but I have no desire to put ads on my site because they annoy me on, various websites they go to when there's a pop-up. I just, so I was like, oh boy, I gotta click this Xbox and in the corner and get rid of this ad. And I don't want that happening on my website. So,
yeah, that's honorable. That's awesome.
Plus, you know, if it's free, then I have, if there's a typo or maybe some outdated piece of information or something that I hope didn't, but might have misled someone, it's free information. So take it all with a grain of salt.
Yeah, fair enough.
No, it just seems like a really amazing passion project, and the amount of information that's been aggregated there, it is really something that's cool. And I even find it like quite motivating. Like, I've obviously only touched the surface of going through your site and stuff, but like reading of your experiences, your trip reports, looking at your hospital reports and stuff, you know, there's something inspiring about it. I feel like I watch Netflix or, you know, waste some time and you're like, you know, aggregating data and making trip reports. It's like, that's what I'm trying to get in my life. I'm like, I just know I'll be like doom scrolling or watching like something in a bit of time off. And I'm like, oh, I know I want to be using this.
What would Steph do? We got to make t-shirts.
Yeah. Just have like, you know, the Steph devil, like in the, what is that? I forget the show, but yeah.
Yeah. All that time that could have been spent watching TV, I've probably put into my website. I've never owned a TV, so.
Yeah, wow. My God, that's honestly probably really an amazing thing to say nowadays. You know, it's something special. It's pretty crazy. Yeah. One last thing, actually, I'd like to ask you a little bit about, just since we have you here, because it's like, why not? So you did a 7-day fast, and like my understanding of that was like, correct me if I'm wrong, but like, you know, when you had the MRSA infection, you obviously took like a massive amount of antibiotics, and that can really affect your gut microbiome. Do you feel like the issues you've had has stemmed from that course of antibiotics?
I kind of do. I mean, I deal with it on a daily basis. My gut is not that healthy. I deal with pretty constant indigestion, bloating, stomach aches. And so I'm always just on the search for something to help. And I have found that fasting is great. I used to do a lot of fasting. I haven't done so much of it these days, although I do intermittent fast quite regularly, where I'll just eat one meal a day, pretty much. Eat within a 3-hour window and then don't eat the rest of the day. So yeah, I have found that fasting is kind of a good tool for helping with that kinds of issue. You're coming out of a longer fast feeling like $1 million. So there's definitely something healing about them. And then keto is also something I've tried, and that is tremendously helpful too for gut issues, or I have found it to be. And just general body inflammation and energy, positive effects on both of those. Inflammation seems to go down. There's absolutely no soreness. You just feel younger. And then energy seems to go up. So I have experimented with keto and fasting and have only positive things to say. They are hard to stick to, though. Much as you feel good during them, and it's like, why would I ever stop? For some reason, it's not something that's just easy to do all the time. And so right now I'm neither. I'm not keto and I'm not like strictly fasting a lot, but it is something I like to bring into my life on occasion.
Yeah, I've definitely messed around with a lot of intermittent fasting. I've been keto. I think obviously like from an endurance standpoint or a climbing standpoint, like training your body to be more adaptive to using, mm-hmm. For fat oxidation and like that low, slow energy, like aerobic system. Like there's a lot of performance benefits, but then also can be a lot of health benefits. But I do find the same thing mm-hmm. as you, where it's like, I will do it. I feel like $1 million. It's almost like I'm like this like car engine. And then somebody just mm-hmm. put like engine cleaner and then like the highest quality, like 97 at the gas tank in me, and I'm like mm-hmm. I'm like amazing, but I'm like I keep that for like 10 days, and then I'm like, all right, I need to eat something that for some reason my body's telling me to eat. So I think it's really, really interesting, like the performance, the mental clarity, just how I feel after doing it, but I can't seem to sustain it, nor do I actually want to. Or like, there's a friend and they're like, hey, let's go grab a beer. And you're like, oh, well, I'm keto. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not going to have a beer or something.
Right.
On some level, it seems really hard to sustain. But I think it's definitely a tool in the box that a mm-hmm. lot more people should start to be aware of, that they can like use or to mess around with to try and feel good. Mm-hmm. And when I read your write-up, like I actually I'm really interested. Like I can't do it like your 7-day fast. Like it's really inspired me. Like I really want to try a longer fast period. And I have a lot of experience with intermittent fasting and ketogenic periods. So like I know I really enjoy it and I feel good. I'm just like right now I'm training to climb Denali in Alaska. So like I'm just nonstop aerobic work. And the idea of not eating for 7 days seems like a drastic performance decline. But I'm really fascinated. Hey, that's true. Actually, you don't know what you don't know. But I'm just really interested to know like what my body would do on a prolonged period like that. So yeah, I thought that was a really cool write-up you had.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, the big takeaway I've had from that fast in particular is yeah, the body can really survive on its own. You don't have to put anything in. I mean, you got to drink. But even if I maybe had a little salt on occasion, but really nothing other than water. And I did allow myself coffee just because it's nice, right? But the body is just so able to just keep on going, keep on functioning. Maybe you lose a little bit of energy. Not to the point where you're feeling weak, but just kind of, sitting around sounds kind of nice, but it's amazing how the body is able to just kind of keep going. And it's kind of good to know that too, especially as like a longer day in the mountains. It's like, and you run out of food. It's like, no big deal. The body's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. It is really amazing to see just from like purely an evolutionary standpoint, like we are so adaptive, and the way I think we are living, like, for the majority of people nowadays, is so contrary evolutionarily to like what our bodies are actually designed to be doing and what they can do. And, mm-hmm. when you see people are like really struggling, and I don't want to diminish their suffering or their individual experience or anything, but like really suffering with like, oh, I can't not eat this meal or something. It's like, trust me, you can. Like your body has like 100,000 calories on it. Like if there was like a gun to your head or something right now, you could literally make it like 100 kilometers of nonstop walking. Mm-hmm. And so it's like really interesting to see like the disparity between how I feel, like the input and the stimulus in my brain telling me for like food and what I want versus like what I'm actually capable of doing. Those are like totally separated entities, right? And it's like we always mm-hmm. want to drift towards the like how I feel or how I think I should feel. And then sometimes that's really contrary to the reality of like what your body is actually like programmed to do or capable of doing. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's interesting.
Yeah, I think the body can do a lot more than we think it can.
Yeah. I think that's a pretty amazing place to stop. I don't know, Kyle, if you have anything else, or Steph, anybody
else?
No,
I think we covered it. Yeah, Steph, unless you have anything else for our audience or for your fans that you want to say.
Thank you for the compliments on my website to this unknown viewer who recommended me. or thanks to my viewers, I guess.
Yeah, no, I just want to say thanks so much for coming on the show and like taking the time to talk to us and everything, Steph. You know, it's been a real pleasure chatting with you and everything, and obviously like having the resource of your website and going through that. It's been really awesome. I really enjoyed having this conversation with you. So thanks so much for taking the time.
Yeah, watch out for those loose rocks, okay?
Yeah. I had never thought about the third one being the knee injury being a loose rock, but you are definitely correct.